Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. One, two, one, two, three, four.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Sydney McElroy, welcome to The Floor. I've gathered all of our weirdest listeners together, and they've made a grid of 16 by 16 squares, and you, Sydney McElroy, are going to attempt to answer all of their most challenging and thought-provoking questions in a segment I'm calling Weird Medical Questions. I'm Rob Lowe.
You're Rob Lowe?
In the floor.
Can I ask you about
segment.
The West Wing?
Yes, you can. I'm always happy to talk about any of my great projects, including Dr. Vegas, The West Wing, or 911.
I'd rather talk to you about The Stand.
I'd
remember
love
when
to
you
talk
were in the original?
Yes, I was the great Nick. Nick in that, and mm-hmm. I did
The great Nick.
The great role of Nick in that, and I did such a good job as that role.
You did do such a great job in that.
Thank you, Sydney. Thank you for always supporting my work.
No problem.
Now,
you know Gary Sinise, and could I meet him?
We don't keep in touch. He's often in space.
Oh. Justin, we are going to do some weird medical questions. It will hopefully not be nearly as tense as this floor situation you just set up for me. If I had to navigate, I would be bad on the floor anyway, and if I had to navigate a floor full of questions that in theory I know the answer to, but then if you put me on the spot and I miss them, I look like I'm bad at my actual trained profession. That's terrifying.
That's right, Sid. We're going to be taking our listeners' questions and we're going to be turning them into answers, not actionable ones, though. This is still just for entertainment.
But yeah, these are just fun questions about medical science. I'm not, as always, if you have a problem or a concern and you need actual medical advice, please see your own healthcare provider who can assess you and know your history and perhaps do a physical exam and then make a diagnostic and treatment plan that is individually suited for you.
Hey, Sid, one of my coworkers recently told me, their doctor told them, Gatorade is only sweet if you're dehydrated. It is salty when you're hydrated. Is that true? How? It's got a lot of sugar in it. How does it become unsweet? Or is it sweet with a touch of salty? I don't understand. Help. Thanks for your help, Sajin.
So I'm not really sure what the other doctor would have meant by it's only sweet if you're dehydrated and it's salty when you're hydrated. I don't know any reason why the taste of Gatorade would, like your perception of it would change based on your hydration status.
Right.
I don't have any evidence for that. I thought it was an interesting thing to point out. I mean, Gatorade is sweet and salty. Mm-hmm. It's not really salty, but like there is salt in it, right?
I mean, that's a real, if you drank water that just had the salt from Gatorade, I think you would be like, huh, I don't know. Like this is a little bit, there's some salt in here.
Well, and I thought it was a good point to talk about why Gatorade, why would it have salt in it? And what does that have to do with like oral rehydration solutions? Mm-hmm. So Gatorade is really good for like if you're playing sports or you're exercising and you're just like normal like fluid electrolyte replenishment as you're engaging in activity. You know what I mean? Like nothing has happened to you to cause you to be like clinically dehydrated, like pathologically dehydrated.
Right.
You're just like
being
active.
Extreme.
Right. And it has more sugar in it than an actual, like, medically designed oral rehydration solution. We have those, ORS, oral rehydration solutions, where, like, instead of giving you a bag of IV fluids because you're dehydrated, we could give you this medically formulated, balanced electrolyte solution that is good for you to get everything back in your body. The closest thing to that over the counter is Pedialyte.
Yes.
Pedialyte is a great example of a much more balanced oral rehydration solution. And the difference between the two, I have the breakdown. I found, like, calories and sugar and sodium and potassium and all that stuff. And if you look at, Justin, I have it here for you to see. Uh-huh. Mm. If you look at the sugar, there's 21 grams of sugar in Gatorade Frost versus 9 grams in Pedialyte.
Okay.
Much more sugar. Gatorade is sweeter. And then the sodium in Pedialyte, 370 mg as opposed to 160 in Gatorade. If you drink Pedialyte, you can tell.
Yeah.
It's salty.
It's salty.
So that does taste salty. I have never drank a Gatorade that I thought tasted anything but sweet or whatever flavor it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I remember when I told my dad, bring me a Gatorade with a bitter flavor. And my father looked at me and I could tell from the look in his eyes that there was no bitter Gatorade.
I will say that if you were just, again, engaging in, like, regular exercise and all that kind of stuff, Gatorade is fine. Pedialyte is fine for adults too and children. If you are actually, you know, you've had diarrhea or vomiting or something else that has caused you to become more dehydrated than you would expect in just, like, normal activities, Pedialyte's a better oral rehydration solution. People like to use it for hangovers for that reason. You can drink too much of it, and there's no need to drink Pedialyte or Gatorade on a regular basis. Like, that's not, for the most part, it doesn't need to be, like, part of a standard healthy diet. It doesn't have to be.
You should also, I will say this, question asker. You should know that this question touches on something that I would like to address now that Sydney has addressed the science. It is still possible. I think it's important to remember that doctors can still hear commercials. And doctors can still hear stuff that is not true about flavors of Gatorade from, like, a friend, right? And if it's not directly impactful to the person's health or well-being, you shouldn't assume that the doctor is going to run it down and find out for sure if it's not a health-related issue. What I'm saying is that doctors can be wrong about lots of stuff all the time. It doesn't have, but they usually will check on it if it is about your health. I don't want you to, what I mean? Like, oh, this is just someone who maybe has heard a coach at some point say something. I don't know.
But you don't, I would say you need the salty when you are dehydrated, but I don't know why you would necessarily taste it more.
This is what I'm saying, so, right? Yeah. Like, yes. Yeah. Doctors being confused about Gatorade flavors is, it's understandable.
I once got a call on the mommy line. It's terrible they called it that. The parent line, the guardian line, the caretaker line is what we should call it. Mm. It's an after hours call line for the PED service. But they asked what flavor of Pedialyte rehydrates a child best.
Bitter Mountain Rush.
I said, whatever they will drink.
I feel like I've watched the first time I tried Gatorade too many times at this point. It's like all I can think about whenever Gatorade is brought up. It, like, the entirety of it fills my consciousness. Hey, Sydney, I got another question for you. Do you have the time?
Yes.
When making pottery, you sometimes score two clay surfaces and apply slip to allow them to stick together better. Let me try this question again. There's a lot of unfamiliar terms, and I feel like my brain didn't have my pottery glossary loaded up. It had my medical terms glossary loaded up, so sure. I wasn't. Try again. Okay, here we go. When making pottery, you sometimes score two clay surfaces and apply slip to allow them to stick together better. Is there any similar technique used to help wounds heal? Would the increased surface area from scoring allow for better recovery? And that is from Deacon.
I thought this was a really interesting question because I couldn't think as it. I was sitting there trying to imagine what medical procedures already sort of mimic this, and nothing immediately came to mind other than dermabrasion, which isn't wound healing per se, but when people have dermabrasion done, which is what it sounds like, it's abrading, like irritating the surface of the skin, the dermis. You're irritating, and you have it done on your face to, like, smooth out and have a, like, smoother, softer appearance to your face. And it's almost like sanding it's not li- you're not literally using a sander, but it's kind of like a sander. You're like sanding off the top surface of your face.
Yeah.
And then it heals into this like the next layer. You're getting all the dead, dry, irregular layers off.
You know where we do this? Nails. We do this on our nail beds, right? Like we've got the first thing they do whenever they do your the work on your fingers is they're like buffing, right? And they're taking away like some of the calloused skin and the nail, the outer layer, right?
Yes.
And part of that is a sanding for smoothing, which is not exactly what this person's talking about. But it's also to rough up the surface so that like the coat will stick better and whatever, right?
And I couldn't
not think... a medical thing technically, but it is the human body, I guess.
Right. And I guess that's similar. I know that's still not exactly what you're asking because this doesn't really have to do with surface area per se. I was thinking about wound care. I do a ton of wound care, and certainly debridement is part of wound care.
Yes.
So we do prep a wound bed before we dress it or perhaps put a skin graft on it. And I was thinking, is there any way where we abrade it in some way to make it take better? Not really. We need a certain kind of wound bed. There has to be blood supply there. It has to be clean. You have to get rid of dead tissue. You have to have good, you know, healthy borders to the whole wound. So there's a lot that goes into that. But none of it is exactly this. You know, the closest I was thinking about it, it's almost worse if you have like inflamed tissues inside the body. Let's say we do a surgery inside the body.
Okay.
And the internal organs irritated, inflamed from just whatever, from whatever caused the need for the surgery or from the surgery itself, right? A surgery, we're still cutting into you. We're doing it in a controlled, sterile fashion, but it can cause inflammation.
Right.
That can actually make things stick together. Adhesions form.
Mm.
So connections we don't want, little pieces of tissue that form between two organs that really shouldn't be stuck together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that does happen.
So it does happen. We just don't want it to happen.
But we don't want it to happen. Because right, if exactly. you get too many adhesions, they can cause pain and problems inside your, usually in an abdominal kind of situation, but wherever they form. And then we might even have to go in and do like a lysis of adhesions, meaning we go in and cut the adhesions apart so things aren't stuck together. But the danger of that is it's another surgery.
Yeah.
So you might get more. Anyway, so I couldn't think of a reason that it would be good as much as reasons why like we probably don't want that.
Let's see here, Sid. What's the deal with Mycoplasma genitalium? Is it new or on the rise or something? Is it included in most STI tests? Should I request it when I get tested?
I thought this was a really great question because I don't think a lot of people are as familiar with this sexually transmitted infection.
Okay.
Had you ever heard of it, Justin?
Not until this exact moment.
So it is less common. I think most of us have heard of, there's a lot of sexually transmitted infections that I think have entered not just like our kind of common knowledge, but I also feel like media vernacular, you know what I mean? Like we talk about gonorrhea and chlamydia a lot more in, you know what I mean? Like I feel like those are plots on like teen shows and things.
Yeah,
this is not. Right. We first identified this back in 1981, so it's not new. I would say it's definitely newer than syphilis, for instance,
sure,
which,
yeah.
you know, is an ancient.
Been driving princes insane for millennia.
Exactly. But, so it is newer in that sense. It's a bacterial infection. It is more rare than some of these other conditions. We think, you know, I believe that the percentage was like 1-3% of people tested positive
All right, but
for
what
it.
What is it, Sydney? What is it?
It causes, it's a bacterial infection that you can transmit through either vaginal or anal sex typically. We don't think at this point it can be transmitted through oral sex, although it's still rare enough that, you know, we're not sure, but we don't think so. And it causes very similar symptoms to other sexually transmitted infections you might be familiar with. So you could get inflammation of the cervix or the urethra or the rectum. You can have vaginal discharge. You could have burning or pain. And there are more serious complications that can arise from this, specifically in people who have uteruses and fallopian tubes. You can experience pelvic inflammatory disease and infertility if it is left untreated long term, similar to gonorrhea, chlamydia, these other. So the symptoms are pretty similar. There's not a lot that would initially distinguish. I'm having some burning when I pee. I'm having some discharge. Maybe my pelvis hurts. It could be any of these things.
Right.
Right now, our standard is that we don't we don't screen for this immediately. If somebody is either not testing positive for these other sexually transmitted infections or if they're not responding to empiric treatment, sometimes we just treat.
What would you take to knock this out? Like, wouldn't it be part of the constellation of stuff that you like? Does it respond to?
It does. So right now we have a lot of good antibiotic choices and they're pretty similar to how we treat other sexually transmitted infections. So in a lot of cases, azithromycin, which is still used for chlamydial infections, we can use.
Is that AZT?
Or doxycycline. No. Oh, okay. That's a totally other. That's an antiretroviral.
Got a lot of those letters though.
Yes.
Can't fault me.
Azithromycin is the same thing that's in a Z-Pak, which many people are familiar with.
Yeah.
Anyway, so azithromycin, moxifloxacin, doxycycline.
No.
We still have options.
No. Say it again. Say that one again. You've never said that to me out loud, and I got to hear it again.
Moxifloxacin.
Oh, man.
No, I think it's good to be aware that this is a different. It is not as common as these other STIs, but if you are having symptoms, and certainly if, and I think it can be really, this is where I think this advocacy can come into play. It can be really awkward or uncomfortable for you to come to a healthcare provider and say, I'm having these specific symptoms, knowing what it might imply and knowing how you might have gotten it. I mean, a lot of people get embarrassed about that. First of all, as a healthcare provider, we're not embarrassed. I can tell you this. We are never embarrassed. There's nothing you're ever going to say that's going to shock or, you know,
it's true.
Make us offended or there's not. I mean, it just.
I've tried her, folks.
It's business as usual. We just want to make you better. We just want to figure out what it is to make you better. But if it doesn't get better, you may think like, oh, man, I don't want to have to go through going back. But it might be something that's a little more rare. And so it is worth going back and saying, hey, my symptoms didn't improve with the stuff you gave me because maybe we need to do a little more testing. And we can test for this and treat it. And obviously partners should be treated as well.
Yes, absolutely. Tell you what, Sid, let's have another question. Can you do one more for
me? Yeah,
we
can do one more.
Break? Why don't edema and enema rhyme?
This really isn't a medical question.
No, but yeah, I'd love to have an answer.
I thought I would try to dig into the etymology of these words to see if, and this is my suspicion. Edema, which is swelling, comes from the Greek word oedema for swelling.
One more time, what is it? Oedema?
I believe, yeah. Oedema.
Oedema. Oedema.
It's one word, and it is pronounced that way for swelling. I think that probably enema, which, and I mean, if you see these two words, I know right now you're listening to the podcast, but if you write them down, E-D-E-M-A, E-N-E-M-A. So I get why the question is there, right? One letter difference, and why then do we put the stress on different parts? If you look at the breakdown of enema, which is, you know, do you know what an enema is?
Yes, I do.
Would you like to describe an enema?
Yes. In the film Batman, Jack Nicholson, as the Joker, announces this town needs an enema. And what he means by that is that the town of Gotham needs to have itself cleaned out rectally.
Yes.
With a wash.
Yeah, you can flush things out of the, you like inject it into the rectum and flush things back out. And there are a variety of ways to do that. And some of them are good medically sound things. And then we've talked about on the show many things that are not medically sound that you shouldn't squirt up your butt. But anyway.
Yes. And that is a surprisingly long list.
And this is a very old, thing. We've been doing enemas for a very, very, very long time. And the ancient Greek, here is where I think this comes into play. There were two separate words, using N, and then to send or throw, hina. And I think that it got combined into in hina, and then in a ma. So I think it's because it came from these two separate words. That's why the stress is different. That is what I'm trying to tell you.
Okay, great.
Full disclosure. I am a medical doctor. I have lots of expertise in that area when it comes to the etymology of different words and breaking down sort of like deconstructing why do we say it this way and where did this come from? Obviously, this is not my area of expertise. But just looking at the ancient Greek derivation of these two terms, I think it is because these two words got combined into enema, whereas this word has always just been edema.
Would you like to do your section on Candida? Would you, as long as we're here in the neighborhood, would you like to duck in on Candida?
I don't know why half of people in the healthcare field call this specific kind of yeast Candida, which is what I was taught, and why the other half call it Candida. I don't know. I don't know who. I don't think anyone's right or wrong.
Yes,
I think
do.
It's all fine. Yes, well,
you do.
I was only yes, ever taught.
You, you liar. Just the same way that I think people are wrong about the Oxford comma.
I always heard Candida in school. I never heard a single professor or doctor or anybody say anything but Candida. And then I think the first time I heard it wrong was probably on a TV show. I heard somebody say Candida and I was like, oh, man, they never get that stuff right. But then somebody on the podcast, I think like a listener, was like, hey, you say Candida. I've never heard it said that way. I always say Candida. And I don't know.
All right.
I don't know. That I cannot answer.
We're going to take a brief break. Then we're going to come back and we're going to talk so much more.
The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth.
You know, it's tempting to say, I'm going to start on the big new thing. You know, when the new year comes, I'm going to get it all figured out. Here's what I want to tell you. There's never been a better time to start your dream than right this second. And there's never been a better way to start than with Squarespace. We've been telling you about Squarespace for years, and that's because it's simply the best way to make a website. I mean, there's no other way to put it than that, folks. People have been using Squarespace to make incredible professional-looking websites. And they look professional because the templates they're using, they are made by real web designers. So they're making, like, building blocks that are going to look great. You just bring your stuff, your images, your things you want to sell, any of that, and Squarespace is going to help you make a great platform for it. Head to squarespace.com/sawbones for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code sawbones to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Sid, scrubs aren't like any other kind of clothes. Is that right? Scrubs aren't just like regular clothes. They're action clothes. They're clothes you gotta be able to perform in.
That's true. That's true. I definitely think that function is the primary concern with scrubs, but as someone who spends I don't want to say the majority of my life, but at least half of my life. No, it is the majority of my time in scrubs. I also
don't know about sleeping. You don't sleep in scrubs.
No, but you could if they're comfortable enough, which these are. But you also want them to look nice. Mm-hmm. And that's what's nice about Figs is that they are very functional. I'm not worried about when I'm down on the sidewalk doing my street medicine and my Figs. But also, I look nice. I get compliments on them. People don't always know they're scrubs.
Oh.
Yeah, that's how nice they look.
Well, that's a huge compliment because I know a lot of times scrubs have a reputation for not looking great and also being kind of itchy.
Yeah, these are not itchy. They're super soft. They're comfortable. I don't sleep in them because I do wear them to work and that would not be sanitary. But if I washed them, I could sleep in them. That's how comfy they are.
Sid, what is the number one reason that you have to do laundry every single week for you personally?
My scrubs.
Your scrubs. And wouldn't that be a little bit easier for anybody who's in the scrub game if they stocked up a little bit, had a few backup pairs?
Absolutely. Get yourself some more Figs. They're antimicrobial, so they'll keep you protected. They're durable, so you can wash them over and over again if you need to, like I do. And like I said, you look nice. You're going to look like a TV doc.
Like a TV doctor.
Yeah, like a TV doc.
It's the perfect time to stock up with some fresh outfits for the year, and Figs just dropped a brand new collection of limited edition styles and accessories. If you're in healthcare or shopping for someone who is, you can get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
If you like Too Many Podcasts, you'll love Soundteap with John Luke Roberts. It's got clips from all your favorite podcasts, such as Diary of a Tiny CEO.
Leonard Sprague, tell me how you make your money.
I go to the beach and I steal people's towels.
Rememberama.
Do you remember the trend of everyone whacking themselves on the head with hammers and mallets when they wanted to lose weight?
And Elty John's lobbly songs.
I'm here today with Kiki D. Hello, Kiki D.
Hello, Elton.
There's dozens of episodes to catch up on, and brand new episodes going out right now. So if you want far, far, far too many podcasts, then look for Soundteap on Maximum Fun. Boop, boop.
All right, we're over 70 episodes into our show. Let's learn everything. So let's do a quick progress check. Have we learned about quantum physics?
Yes, episode 59.
We haven't learned about the history of gossip yet, have we?
Yes, we have. Same episode, actually.
Have we talked to Tom Scott about his love of roller coasters?
Episode 64.
So how close are we to learning everything?
Bad news. We still haven't learned everything yet.
Oh, we're ruined!
No. It's good news as well. There is still a lot to learn.
Woo!
I'm Dr. Ella Hubber.
I'm regular Tom Lum.
I'm Caroline Roper, and on Let's Learn Everything, we learn about science and a bit of everything else too.
And although we haven't learned everything yet, I've got a pretty good feeling about this next episode.
Join us every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to the show. We hope you are ready to learn even more than you did in the last half. That's my prediction. I have pretty bad cat allergies, and I was wondering, are people who are allergic to house cats also allergic to big cats? I imagine if I'm close enough to a tiger to find out, then I have bigger concerns than whether or not I get itchy. Yeah, fair enough. All right, Sydney, what's the story?
The short answer is yes. So I had to look this up. I didn't know. I assumed because we're talking about felines, you know, whether tigers and lions, we're talking about other kinds of felines, that they probably have similar kinds of proteins and that then therefore you may well be allergic. And then yes, the primary cat allergen is called FEL-D1. It is a protein that's made in various glands on a cat, salivary, sebaceous glands, like oil glands. It's found in their skin, and therefore it's in their fur. And so that is what you're allergic to if you're allergic to house cats.
Okay.
This same protein, FEL-D1, is indeed found in big cats.
Hmm.
So, yes, if you're allergic to house cats, more than likely you'd be allergic to lions and tigers. I imagine...
And?
No, bears are not felines.
I was going to say pumas. Bears are not cats. Why would I think bears?
Well, it's...
Sorry.
Now, here's an interesting question. Do bears have the FEL-D1 protein?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Like,
because
bears don't have
FEL.
Enough natural advantages on us. Now they're making us sneeze too. These terrible beasts.
I think it is exactly what you mentioned. We probably don't talk a lot about people being allergic to lions and tigers.
Did I ever tell you about the time I saw a black bear on a road, Sydney?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was there.
You weren't.
I mean, you told me about it after. Like, I was there that day. Like, you came up and
don't
said, I just saw
a
bear.
No, I see you. You're trying to retcon yourself into my incredible bear adventure.
Okay, I meant I was here that day, and you told me about it afterwards. I can't find it. This is not easily Googleable. You did. Well, because you got out of your car to try to chase the bear or whatever, and I was like, why did you get out of your car? If you want to look at the bear from your car and then drive away from the bear.
It's a strange time in my life.
Don't get out of your car to look at the bear. Don't get close enough to a lion or a tiger to find out if you're allergic.
There, that's the official medical thing. My boss is currently talking my ear off about... Sorry, it does say taking my ear off. I'm a question asker, I love you. Typos are all right if they're fun. My boss is currently taking my ear off about how eating a spoonful of Celtic salt every day fixed her blood pressure and stopped her legs from cramping. I've never heard of such a thing, and I'm highly skeptical. And then the boss said to look it up on YouTube. So what's up with Celtic salt, Sydney?
When I put these questions together, I actually left this listener's name out because I didn't want your boss to get mad at you. So I'm sorry if I didn't know if you wanted your name included, but it felt dicey. It felt risky. Mm. What if your boss feels like they're getting put on blast and there's repercussions in the workplace? So here's the thing about Celtic sea salt, which I had to look up, like, what is the difference between Celtic salt and other salts? All these sea salts... You know how they harvest sea salt, Justin?
Yeah, they go out to the sea, and then they bring back buckets, and then they let it evaporate, and they take this.
And you get salt. Left. So it takes a while to collect these salts. I would say that's part of the price difference. Mm-hmm. Part of the idea behind them. They are artisanal in that sense. And certainly, salts from all over the world are going to be slightly different, because the mineral composition of the salt in the water in different parts of the ocean is different. And so every salt will be slightly different. Mm-hmm. The majority of any of these sea salts is sodium chloride salt, what we think of as salt, right? NaCl, sodium chloride. I think like up to like 98%. the differences between them are these small amounts of other trace minerals that are slightly different from part of the world to part of the world. Mm-hmm. Why are you laughing at me?
Well, Sid, while you're, I just want a little bit of equal time here to tell you what some of the ambassadors of Celtic Seesaw have to say. Like, salt is not to be underestimated. It is a beautiful, pure, powerful, and helpful mineral that Earth provides us with for healing and maintaining excellent health. There are so many fun ways to use Celtic sea salt. Now, Jordan disagrees. He says, I've enjoyed using Celtic sea salt for several years now. It enhances the flavor of whole foods and provides me and my family with superior sources of trace minerals. So I guess it doesn't improve the flavor of not whole foods, you absolute dorks.
I don't know. So, like, Celtic sea salt, by the way, can come from different locations. Like, they make it in Hawaii, Portugal,
This is also
France.
A brand, to be clear. There is a Celtic sea salt brand. Yeah. That is what I am reading here.
It is not, yes. Yeah, so, not Celtic, thinking, like, from the Celtic part of the world. It is Celtic. That is,
brand
I don't know.
Sea
yeah.
salt.
And, I mean, it's comparable. Like, if you look at all of the different fancy, like, Himalayan sea salt, all the different fancy salts, if you look at the breakdown, they all have, like, mostly sodium. And then, like, this one, for instance, has 2 milligrams of potassium and 1/4 teaspoon and 5 milligrams of magnesium. And they all have different breakdowns of these trace elements, right? Yeah. The potassium, magnesium, calcium, and then, of course, mainly sodium. It's salt. And, none of the medical benefits that have ever been attributed to these various salts, whether we're talking about Celtic sea salt or Himalayan or, I don't remember, there's a whole list of all the other salts. We've never found any benefit in any sort of study. The idea that it could, and specifically Celtic sea salt, I saw people saying it can impact your blood sugar. I don't know. It's not a carb. Up or down. So I don't know how that would happen. In terms of cramps, if you have not enough salt in your body, like if your salt is low, that one of the symptoms you might have are some cramps, muscle cramps. Mm-hmm. But there is no salt that is superior at helping with that to another salt. Mm-hmm. Any salt, table salt, all salts would give you more salt. So that's not really well-founded science. And then blood pressure-wise, too much salt can make your blood pressure higher. So certainly I would not, like, standardly advise salt as a treatment for blood pressure. No, there's no founding to any of this. All the salts are fine. If anything, it's like usually the flakes are bigger. And so if you're measuring 1/4 teaspoon of this kind of salt as opposed to table salt, you're probably getting less.
Are you talking about cooking now? Because I will talk about the impact of this kind of salt on cooking.
Well, but what I'm saying is that it's less if you're worried about too much salt in your diet. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, you're not saying like adjusting recipes. You're talking about like you would maybe...
You would end up using a little less of this because the flakes are bigger. But I mean, I know. I'm searching for anything. I think it's fine if you like this salt, that's fine. But I don't know of any medical reason why this would be better than any other salt.
You know, I just want to touch on this because I think this talking about this kind of stuff, the media literacy stuff, like, is important. I was talking about meet our ambassadors, right? And I was reading the quotes from the quote unquote ambassadors who are making the health claims, right? This salt energizes, replenishes electrolytes, fights bacterial infection, and aids digestion, right? But it's important to note that there's one ambassador who is the CEO of the company who says, being your trusted source of sea salt has been an honor I cherish and take with the utmost responsibility. Thank you for trusting the Celtic sea salt brand for 40 years now and counting, making no health claims. The CEO does not say that it will do any of that. She leaves that to the uncredited, unqualified.
It's the testimonials.
Testimials.
It's the oldest trick in medicine.
And I just wanted to, it's like so fun to see it in action. If you know what you're looking for. This is how they're able to get away with this stuff because they have these strangers making these claims and then the boss doesn't make any claims.
Just say it's like really good salt.
Yeah.
You can always just say that.
For well-being, the sea is the limit. I agree with that, but not for salt. It's just the sea in general and the healing powers of the sea. But you can't get that in a bottle, Sydney. You got to get out there.
You got to get out there.
You got to get out there.
To the sea. Justin, this is a quick one I bet you could answer.
Wow. Yeah, I know you didn't mean for that to sound how it did, but even you, Justin. My boss, that was the last one. I just got over norovirus and listened to your episode on it. I love Justin's rhyme, a fecal oral route with to mouth from poop chute. Gross. You said that 20 particulates can spread norovirus and that it is contagious for 2 weeks. You mainly discuss washing hands as a way to avoid spreading it. My question is, if a fart could spread norovirus, that's from liquid leaking in Lansing.
Justin, can you fart and spread norovirus?
Can you fart and spread norovirus? No.
That's correct.
Because the particulate would be caught by your BVDN95 that you're wearing wrapped around your tuchus. You're double layered there, probably.
It is not an airborne particle. Smelling a fart will not make you ill in that you have not contracted a contagious disease. So no, don't worry. Don't worry.
Don't worry.
You can't. That is not a way to get norovirus. Norovirus is no fun, though, folks. So wash your hands before you eat and after you go to the bathroom, and then just extra times in between. Especially if you're sick or taking care of somebody, helping clean clothes or sheets or whatever. If somebody's been sick, lots of hand washing will save you hours in the bathroom.
I have a chronic pain condition. I regularly take OTC painkillers like Tylenol 4. Sometimes I consider taking them before bed, but I've always assumed they wouldn't help because I'd be asleep by the time I felt their effects. This got me wondering if that was actually correct. Could painkillers still benefit me while I'm asleep? I think we understand the question. What do you think, Sid?
Yes, and that's from Sylvie. Yeah, they do, because this is what I would say. I understand that pain is a complex concept, right? It is not one single thing that's happening in your body. It's a bunch of different receptors and mechanical and also, emotional and neurological. And there's all kinds of factors involved in the pain response. It's a big, complex thing. So how can you experience that when you're asleep? Well, certainly you can still experience pain that would disrupt your sleep.
Yeah.
So, and even if it's not awakening you to the point where you are aware, I'm awake because of my pain, it can disrupt your sleep architecture. So you may not be going, we want you to go through steady waves of the deep, down to the deep stages of sleep and back up and through REM sleep and then down. And these well-defined sleep cycles are really important for your brain health and so that you feel well-rested and for your overall health for the next day. And pain definitely can disrupt that sleep architecture, even though it is, like I said, a complex response. And there are probably aspects of it that are quieted by a sleeping brain. There are other aspects that will not be. And so, yes, painkillers are doing something while you are sleeping. Hopefully, they are allowing you to have more restful, restorative sleep.
I'm pregnant. Surprise.
Congratulations.
No, honey. It's the question.
I know.
Congratulations
to you, too.
I've been reading a lot about embryonic development. I remember that, those days, seeing all the different fruits the baby was. A lot of fun. I know that baby develops taste buds, but to what extent can baby taste food in the womb? Does the baby develop preferences to different foods that I eat? And if so, can they communicate that with us? If I eat something that's too spicy for me, is that too spicy for the baby? Thank you for all that you do, Liv.
So, yes, the baby develops taste buds around 8 weeks. That's when they start. And then they're ready at 14 weeks to detect molecules that are floating around in the amniotic fluid. So yes, what you are eating is what becomes these teeny little molecules that are filling the amniotic fluid, and your baby is swallowing that amniotic fluid. So is tasting it. By 24 weeks, by the way, they also have odor sensing ability, and we know odor is tied to taste. And by 30 weeks, we know that those taste buds have formed the neurological tracts to communicate that back to the brain. Because, right, there's the sensing the taste and then what that means to the brain. So by 30 weeks, a fetus can taste.
It was just making me think about the time where we went and got hot pot at that Korean place, Pocha 32, I think it was called.
And I was...
The idea of Charlie just swimming around a bunch of spicy hot pot, hot dog slices. And
I was indeed 30 weeks pregnant at the time. I remember it was the worst acid reflux I've had in my entire life. This is not the food's fault. I was just very pregnant and had acid reflux anyway. And no, the food was delicious, but I did sit up all night crying from acid reflux. So it was but here's the good thing. I did not harm Charlie. There is no evidence that eating spicy foods is going to like cause, you can't eat something that's so spicy that like the fetus is in distress from the spiciness.
So if it wasn't that, what did we do?
No, I had acid reflux.
No, I mean, if it wasn't the spicy food that messed our kids up, like where else do we go?
Here's what is interesting. There are some studies that have looked into if you eat a wider variety of foods while you're pregnant, will that influence your baby's preferences later in life? There was one study specifically on carrots where they were like, drink a bunch of carrot juice while you're pregnant, and then we're going to see if your kid likes carrots down the road, which I don't know. Based on the study, they were like, yeah, we think it does influence your carrot preference. So there's a chance that it does influence taste later in life. One way or another, do not stress about it. I would say of all the things, having been pregnant twice myself, of all the things for you to worry about, making sure your kid likes a lot of different foods later or that you're not eating things too spicy, don't worry about those things. Don't worry about those things.
Take it from me. You're going to have plenty of time to worry about your kid not eating lots of different foods. You do not need to waste time right now.
Eat what nourishes your body and your soul right now. Yeah. You're working hard.
Yeah. I got bronchitis a month ago and still coughing up phlegm. People keep saying I need to clear it all out, but that can't be right, can it? I don't want to read more of this question. It grosses me out in a pretty major way, but that's from Kat.
I thought that it was important this time of year to remind everybody of the post-infectious cough.
Yeah.
So you can cough even after you've gotten rid of whatever your illness was. You can have a cough, and we're talking about upper respiratory stuff, cold, flu, like, you know, bronchitis-y, all that stuff. That cough can last for up to 8 weeks. They typically don't last that long, but occasionally they do. Now, obviously, if it's continuing past 8 weeks, please go be reevaluated. We wouldn't expect that. However, if you come in and this happens a lot, a couple weeks, and you're like, man, all my other symptoms are gone, but I'm still coughing. That is a post-infectious cough. It is caused by, you've got inflammation of those airways. So even though all the germs are gone, the damage they did is still repairing itself. It's still healing. You've got all those teeny little cilia, the little hair-like things that line your airways that are trying to grow back and clear mucus out. And as they're coming back, they're still clearing out all that mucus. You're still producing more mucus from all this inflammation and irritation. It takes a while. Just because the invading army of bacteria or viruses is gone doesn't mean that all the destruction they cause has been completely repaired. This is how I always explain it. All that destruction has to be repaired by your body, and it takes a while. And part of that process is going to be coughing. Yeah. So it's irritating. Over-the-counter meds, based on your own medical conditions as appropriate, over-the-counter meds can be helpful. But time, it's just the tincture of time.
Hello, who are some of your favorite doctors in fiction? Lastly, this question asker mentioned Bones McCoy and Dr. Tiana from Lower Decks.
I just thought this would be a fun one for us to, who's your favorite fictional doctor?
Oh, man. Well, Dusty, you really sprung that on me. You've had all this time to think about it.
I know. I'll start off. It's hard because it's boring because everybody knows that Hawkeye is my favorite fictional doctor, Hawkeye from MASH. Mm-hmm. I have lots of doctors that I love. I love John Carter is always going to be one of my favorite fictional doctors. I was always kind of partial to, I love Dr. Cox from Scrubs, but also Elliot was a great doc. I don't think anybody's in Dr. Odyssey. Come on, Dr. Odyssey.
Dr. Odyssey.
No, but it's always going to be Hawkeye. He's the doctor that I've been, I think, trying to be my career.
Do you know who I like? If I had to pick, and because this person talked about Star Trek, and it reminded me of one of my favorite doctors, it was Robert Picardo. And he was the doctor on Star Trek Voyager, which was the one that Kay Mulgrew and we did. But he was a hologram. Mm. And I always really enjoyed the idea of a doctor that doesn't have – it was always a really interesting dynamic because he was the ship's physician, but he was the memory of this other doctor. But it was a hologram, like it was an AI hologram, right? So, but he would advise them. It would always be this like conflict of, you know, well, you're not even really a human being. Like, you know, it's very easy for you to say you're not a person. But he did a great performance, and it was probably him.
Well, there you go. You picked something more obscure, so I picked something more obvious. That worked well. I should have mentioned Christine Yang from Grey's Anatomy. I know I fell off on Grey's Anatomy after a while, but what a great representation of a woman in medicine. Tough and brilliant.
Yeah. Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman.
Oh, well, yeah, Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. I didn't watch a lot of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, so it's seems hard for like me to, I mean, it, I know, it
is
feels...
Is it time for a rewatch podcast, Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, Sydney?
I probably should, is I probably should.
What if that becomes your new thing? What if you're like, J-Man, I'm 6 seasons in to Dr. Quinn? Hey, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for all the help in the past 2 weeks with the Max Fun Drive for everybody that chipped in there. Thank you so much. The doctor, by the way, on Voyager didn't have a name. It was just the doctor, which is why I couldn't remember his name. He is based on the form of Lewis Zimmerman, but that is not his name. He's just the doctor. Okay. So there you go.
Okay.
There you go. That is going to do it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to the taxpayers for use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. And thanks to you for listening. That's going to do it for us. Until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your hand.
All right. Yeah.
Maximum Fun.
A worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported directly by you.